Hello everyone and welcome back to the Brexit podcast. It has been quite an eventful week because on Tuesday the Supreme Court announced that it was deciding the Article 50 legal challenge in favour of the claimants and against government, bringing to a close one of the most important and perhaps most controversial constitutional law cases in decades. If you want a refresher on what that case exactly was about and why it was brought forward, listen back to episode 9 for our interview with leak claimant Gina Miller. But if you want to find out what the court decided on Tuesday and what this will mean going forward, keep listening because we brought in Stephen Chater from Postlethwaite Solicitors and the UK 200 Group to bring us up to date on just that. If you enjoy the show, you can subscribe to us wherever you're listening to this podcast, and you can also, you know, rate and subscribe, and I've already said subscribe, rate and review us, that's it, because it really helps us out. And if you enjoy the show, please do give us a quick rate and review wherever you're listening to this podcast, and while you're there, you can also subscribe to us so you can get all upcoming episodes sent straight to your phone. You can also find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen Chater.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for coming on. So, to start off with quite a broad question, why is it that we had to have a court case like this in the first place?
It's quite unusual to have a constitutional law case of this high profile, and it really stems from the fact that the legislation which was passed by Parliament to allow the EU referendum in the first place was completely silent on what would happen if the UK voters decided that the UK should leave the European Union. Typically, legislation would cover consequences, but Parliament decided for one reason or another that it was not appropriate in that legislation. So when it came to the point that the government needed to think about how to progress things, there were different views, and therefore it became a matter for the courts to decide which was the right view.
And for those of us who might not be completely up to date on this, could you give us a little rundown of what exactly the two sides of the argument were?
Yes. The government's argument was that once the voters had decided in the referendum what should be done in relation to whether they should stay in the EU or leave, it was then until a final deal had been agreed. And this was an exercise of something called the Royal Prerogative, which is a constitutional law concept which allows the executive power in the country, originally the Crown, now through the Prime Minister, to do certain things without the legislature, Parliament. So that was the argument on one side. On the other side, the argument was that the vote on the referendum, under the referendum, was simply to indicate the direction of travel. It did not give any assistance on how that should be achieved. And therefore, the fallback position was that the elected representatives of the voters, i.e. Parliament, should be required to authorise the way in which things should be done. And the initial step in leaving the EU would be to give notice under what Article 50 of the treaty, and therefore the case revolved around whether a parliamentary vote would be required in order to trigger Article 50. That's the part of the case which has received the highest profile. There is another element which has had less publicity, but probably had greater significance from the point of view of the timetable, which was that there is a convention which maintains that the devolved assemblies in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland needed to be at least consulted, if not have their approval required, before certain steps are taken regarding what are called devolved treaties. And therefore the question was whether leaving the European Union would involve devolved issues and would therefore require approval of those devolved assemblies, which could be quite problematic.
Mm. So before we move on to what the actual Supreme Court decision was today, I just want to quickly touch on the amount of backlash that this case received, that the judges received, and that the claimants received. And I'm wondering whether you think that this is indicative of sort of a fundamental lack of trust in the political system here in the UK, because people are so reluctant to let their own elected government have a say on whether Article 50 should be triggered.
That's a very broad question, and I'd like to make a couple of points in response to that. The first point is in relation to what I would regard as the polarisation of opinion. Because the views of a lot of people who voted Leave were that there should be nothing that should prevent the UK from leaving the EU, that it should just straightforward from there, and anything that was put in the way must be wrong. On the other side of the argument, there were a number of people who were on the Remain side of the argument who were keen to put any hurdle in the way of the UK leaving the EU. So I think that's the first point on polarisation of opinion. Can I go on with the next point?
Yes, of course.
Yes. That's fine. One of the things that caught people unawares was the attack on the judiciary and the fact that many people said that they simply weren't independent. And I think that was a very great concern, because the judiciary is indicative of the rule of law in this country. And I think it is something that we should be very proud of. And I'm pleased to say that after that initial backlash, we haven't heard anything further about that.
Mm.
You also mentioned about lack of confidence in elected representatives. I think that there is a certain amount of concern that there are MPs who have views which are quite different from their electors. For example, in my home constituency, our MP is very vociferous in favour of Leave, but his electors were very pro-Remain. So, although I don't think it's indicative of a lack of confidence, it is indicative of an absence of listening to electors. And I think that that is something that will need to be taken account of in the future.
Do you know of any steps that have been taken to sort of make that relationship, that sort of trust in our elected representatives to enact our will, or anything that you think could be done in the future in this regard?
I'm not aware of anything so far, but it has given a number of MPs in that situation pause for thought. And it has created quite a number of
I thought one of the reasons that the Labour Party seemed to have such a problem in establishing a party line is that if you look at the 25 constituencies that were most in favour of Leave, 20 of those have Labour MPs. But the 25 constituencies most in favour of Remain also have Labour MPs. So it's extremely difficult to square a single party line with that range of view.
Mm. So if we're moving on to the Supreme Court decision that was announced today, the statement that was released was quite long. What do you think were the most important points that you would like people to know about?
Just one thing before we go on to the today's decision. The previous decision at the High Court level was itself quite unusual, because the three judges at High Court included the two most senior possible judges that could have been chosen, the Lord Chief Justice and the Master of the Rolls, and it's very unusual for them to be sitting together. The other thing is that the hearing before the Supreme Court was filmed, and that is unprecedented. And the Supreme Court justices sat, all 11 of them, again, unprecedented. And all this is indicative of the sensitivity behind all this. So moving on to today's judgment. In a nutshell, the Supreme Court decided that the government line was wrong, that the government did not have the authority to trigger Article 50 without the approval of Parliament. Having said that, three of the 11 Supreme Court judges had thought that the government did have that power. And I think that just goes to show how difficult some of these issues are, that if you get 11 of the best legal minds in the country together, you're bound to get some divergence of view.
Mm.
So that was the decision on the parliamentary point. The decision on the devolved assemblies seems to have given the judges less difficulty, because they decided unanimously that the approval of the devolved assemblies was not required. So the result of that outcome is that there is less likelihood that the government's proposed timetable will be put off course.
Okay. Could you give us a bit more detail into the rationales for these two decisions? How did they explain their decisions?
Yes. On the first one, the judges really took the same line as the High Court and said that the European Union, when the UK joined the common market, as it then was, there was parliamentary legislation. And in order to start changing that legislation, Parliament would need to be involved again. And it wasn't sufficient that there would be a parliamentary vote simply on the final agreed deal. Parliament would need to be involved the outset of the process on the triggering of Article 50.
Mm.
On the devolved assemblies, I think the view was that the relationship between the UK and European Union were not part of the devolved issues that concern devolved assemblies, and therefore they didn't need to be consulted.
Have you heard anything about reactions from the governments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland?
So far, the reactions have been relatively muted. I think that the Welsh Assembly seems to be arguing for a slightly different way of approaching the discussions with the EU. The population of Wales seem to be in favour of leaving in any event, so I don't think that there would be much reaction there. Scotland is a slightly different case because the Scottish National Party is very much in favour of Remain, so I would imagine that there would be some adverse reaction, but I don't think that there's going to be much that they can do about it. The Northern Ireland Assembly, of course, they're waiting for their election in March, so it's really a bit of a non-event as far as they're concerned.
Mm. So do you think there's any reason to be concerned that the decision not to consult the devolved assemblies might sort of result in further division and maybe even ultimately an independence referendum after all?
I suspect that if it is left to the Scottish National Party, they would want to use this as an excuse for an independence referendum at a time that they thought that they might be able to win, which is not at the moment because the economic conditions are not favourable for independence at present. But one thing that they would need to explain to the electors is that although a majority of Scots who voted in the EU referendum voted to stay in the EU, the number of those Scottish voters was actually less than the Scots who voted to remain in the UK in the independence referendum.
Mm.
So the Scottish National Party saying, well, most Scots want to stay in the EU, that's not the end of the story, because even more Scots voted to stay in the UK, and they tend to ignore that.
Mm. So a spokesperson of Number 10 has stated that it is important to remember that Parliament backed the referendum by a margin of 6-1 and has already indicated its support for getting on with the process of exit to the timetable we've set out. Do you think there is any chance at all of either Parliament or the House of Lords actually voting not to set Article 50 in process and to remain in the EU?
I think it's pretty unlikely on the numbers that we've seen at the moment. The indications are that there was only one Conservative MP that would not vote in favour, and that's Ken Clarke. And we have been told by Jeremy Corbyn that he will not do anything to frustrate the triggering of Article 50. Although there has been a certain amount of safeguarding, saying that there might be some conditions attached to the bill to trigger Article 50. So I'm not quite sure how you square that with not frustrating the triggering of Article 50, but I think we'll see how that pans out. But on the face of it, from what we've say, the only organised groups that would be voting against the triggering of Article 50 would be the Scottish National Party and the Liberal Democrats in the House of Commons, which I think would be fewer than 70 MPs. So there should on the face of it be a very large majority in the House of always rather more unpredictable. And the thinking is that if it was left to their own consciences, there would have been a large majority in favour of Remain. And of course, there is, for example, a disproportionately large group of Lib Dem peers in the House of Lords in comparison with their representation in the House of Commons. So that is slightly more unpredictable. But having said that, I suspect that the government could say, well, the referendum was in our manifesto, and therefore we would invoke what is called the Salisbury Convention, which is that the House of Lords cannot frustrate the wishes of the House of Commons on anything that was in the incoming government's manifesto.
So in regards to those conditions you were talking about that might be attached to the invoking of Article 50, Tim Farron, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, mentioned something along the lines of wanting there to be an assurance that Article 50, the final deal, will have to go through Parliament, and then they would be quite accommodating to setting Article 50 into place. Are those the kinds of conditions you were talking about, and were there any others that were mentioned?
Sort of conditions that I have heard being discussed. I think that particular condition is not really controversial, because the government has said that it will put the final deal to a parliamentary vote. I suspect that is meaningless, because by that stage, we will be out of the European Union. There's no going back. So if Parliament votes against the deal, then the UK is just left out in the cold with nothing. So I think that Parliament would probably have to vote in favour of that deal to keep things together.
So considering how, as we just discussed, how highly likely it is that Article 50 will get invoked on time and everything will run very smoothly in that regard, do you think that the entire court case was then more of a formality to set a precedent that the royal prerogative cannot be used in this way, rather than actually being any sort of significant roadblock to Brexit?
I think that the case has been an interesting one, because we have constitutional law cases at this level so rarely. And some of the things that have been said have been really quite interesting. But it is a very, very narrow point. This sort of issue doesn't arise very frequently. And therefore, I think a lot of people are very, very excited over a pretty obscure issue. It's been a bit of a mystery to a lot of people as to why the government sought to appeal to the Supreme Court, because they lost fairly heavily in the High Court, and most informed commentators thought that they would lose in the Supreme Court, as they have done. And all the government has done really is to waste a lot of money, but has probably bought a bit of time, which might be in its favour. I think, in theory, this is not the end of the matter, because it is possible for government to appeal against the decision of the Supreme Court. But that appeal will be heard by the European Court of Justice. So I really don't think that the government would want to be seen to be doing that.
Yeah, definitely not. So, finally, are there any predictions you could make about how this ruling could influence things going forward? Perhaps how the Parliament now holds government to more accountability over Brexit because of this, or anything else in that direction?
I don't think it tells us very much about accountability. I think what it does help us with is try to flush out some of the issues that we now have with the fact that we do seem to be having more referendums. And the referendum traditionally hasn't formed part of the UK constitution. We have general elections to elect our representatives, and then between those elections, we've traditionally left it to our representatives to make decisions on our behalf. Once you start introducing referendums on particular issues, then that rather cuts across the role of the elected representative. And I think what this has done is to indicate that even though you might have a very clear question to which there is a sort of yes-no answer, that still means that the elected representatives in Parliament continue to have a role, that you don't have the population as a whole just overriding the role of Parliament.
So did the inclusion of referendums into the UK political process come about as a part of the UK becoming a member of the EU, or how did that come about?
It came about because of political expediency, really. The referendum before the EU referendum was on the voting system.
Mm.
And that came out of the coalition between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats, because it was part of the horse trading that the Liberal Democrats would be given a referendum on that particular issue. In relation to the Scottish independence referendum, there was no legal need for that. It was political expediency, so that the Westminster government allowed a referendum in the hope and expectation that the population of Scotland would vote against, as it did. So it's not really a legal requirement to introduce legal referendums. It has absolutely nothing to do with our membership of the European Union. It's purely domestic political expediency.
Okay, so do you think there's going to be more of a trend towards having referendums, or do you think, seeing what has happened to Cameron in the wake of this referendum that he initiated, do you think people have maybe been, or politicians have been, put off it now?
I would hope that politicians have now seen enough of how disastrous referendums can be, and that we would see the last of it. However, being realistic, I suspect that we're going to be stuck with more referendums, sadly.
There's nothing like ending on a realistic note. Thank you again so much for coming on. It's been really informative. As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at brexitpodcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.